and more, and I'm really, really happy to be here doing a week of sessions on family and how to practice faith in the midst of all of the chaos of life. Every session, I kind of want to start in this, I'm going to do some of the same pattern, and I'd like to start with just a meditative reading that is, every day it's going to be some scripture, but it'll sort of percolate in the background as we get to the topic for the day, and we'll come back to it, I think, as we talk about the topic. So the meditative reading I want to start with today is a very familiar story from Luke 10. And I hope by the end we understand this story a little differently than when we came in. Now, as they went on their way, he entered a certain village where a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister named Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to what he was saying. But Martha was distracted by many tasks. So she came to him and asked, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself? Tell her then to help me." But the Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and distracted by many things. There is need of only one thing. Mary has chosen the better part, which will not be taken away from her." I think it was actually wonderful that we had children's voices. Today is a session called Sanctifying the Ordinary. If anything, I want to redeem Martha. I want us to honor Martha in the midst of all of the work and labor of caring for a home. It might help me just to hear, have each of you introduce yourself briefly, just by name and, you know, your interest, what drew you to this session. And then I would like to do the same, tell you what my hopes are, and talk a little bit about the practice today of sanctifying the ordinary. Or talk a lot about that. That's what we'll spend most of our time on. But just if we could start, just tell us who you are, what drew you.
Okay. I'm Nick. From Cannon Falls, Minnesota. And I'm a pastor. My wife is a pastor. We have four children. 19 down to age 10, and in a lot of ways, being professional church people, of course our kids want to go another direction. So trying to find a way, think about ways to have a healthy spirituality in the family, in the home, without always being the religious leaders. So.
I'm Grandpa's from Madison, Wisconsin, and our church is doing a lot with youth and family stuff at the Plattsburgh Family Institute, so I thought I could hear something fresh.
I'm Karen Schmidt, I'm from Puyallup, Washington, and I am fortunate and challenged to have a blended family with six children, 11 to 23. I don't have them all the time, but sometimes we do. It's so chaos and finding peace and harmony within that sort of setting is something I'm really interested in.
I'm Christy Bach from Portland, and I'm mother to two, almost six-year-old, and then 1.5-year-old. That's my dearest friend, and I talk to her, and makes my chaos seem like nothing when I talk to her, but it's still chaotic, and
Doug Hazen from Silverdale, Washington. My wife and I, we raised three kids that are now all adults, but now we're raising a niece and nephew that are 12 and 13. And I had no church background before they came to live with us just over 3 years ago. We've been holding this our third trip, coming for 5 days, and the two of them love it. so we're, you know, we're looking at ways to reinforce that we are a family, more of us.
I'm Jim, my wife Renee, we're from Austin. We have a 8-year-old daughter. We've all done our life backwards from everyone else. Having been married for over 30 years. We know the church that we grew up in and we were comfortable with, and we know that church won't hold our daughter. And we're excited to give her experiences like Holden and our church camps and the things that we do there that will keep organized religion or faith in this kind of setting alive for her. And we're always surprised at how much we learn for ourselves too.
And I'm Renee, did all that, and just interested in the topic and raising this 8-year-old.
I'm Rachel Ronnie Linden, and I'm from Los Angeles, California, and I'm pregnant with our first child. So thought it was a perfect topic to kind of come and start thinking in a different mindset than maybe how I have been. So.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm Dan Anderson Little from St. Louis, Missouri. I'm a Presbyterian pastor, living more introduces off in a second. Ditto all the first guy said, two pastors having a family life that has a rich but not institutionalized spirituality, and also really struggling as a pastor with a model of Christian education that really served a different era. And we can't get rid of it, but we are really struggling for something new to emerge as well.
Nate Dougherty, from Watoma, Wisconsin. And I'm here because I have two daughters that are 5 and 3. And also working with a number of families at our church and trying to develop a birth to three Sunday school and kind of infusing faith at the younger age instead of waiting until three. So this topic interests me.
I'm Linda Anderson Little. I'm married to him. I'm a Lutheran pastor in St. Louis. Everything that's been said about the two clergy family is, our life is pure insanity. A lot of times with the three kids' sports and music schedules and our meeting schedules. And I'm also interested because I've done some writing myself, just personal essays about my family and where we find the sacred in the everyday, where we experience God in the midst of everyday life. So I'm interested in engaging that topic.
I'm Tanya, and from Bellingham, Washington, and I have two kids, 7 and 2 and a half. And I guess mostly I'm here because my 7-year-old son, who adores his grandma and papa, who are strong Christians. I'm more eclectic, but he adores his grandma and papa, and so he's really interested in Christianity, and so I want to honor his missions and ideas and stuff. So I'm just trying to figure out ways to do that.
Hi, I'm Dawn Coffey, and I work here at Holden on long-term staff. And my husband and I have 7 children, and the oldest is 28 and the youngest is 6.
And you're darning pants.
Mending.
Yeah, mending.
I'm Eric Massonary, and my wife Yolanda and 8-year-old son Noah and I are here for a couple weeks at Holden. And I'm on sabbatical from a pastorate in Kansas, and it's good to be on sabbatical. And some of the themes that I'm choosing to focus on during the sabbatical time really resonate with what you described in this opening session, so I was curious to hear more. And just have found that being a spouse and being a parent have been two of the most challenging and transforming spiritual practices I think I've ever encountered.
Amen.
So.
I'm Annalisa. Eric is my brother. And I'm from Bellingham too. And I have, this is Elena. She's 3, and her twin brother Reese and her older brother Soren are in the room. I feel like for the last couple years I'm craving some kind of spiritual discipline, some kind of practice that I have not been able to carve out time for, and I'm finally realizing it needs to just be a part of what's already going on, because finding time for something separate is not happening.
I'm Danielle from Mesa, Arizona, and I have 3 children, and I run a daycare and preschool in my home. And I need to figure out how to, out of all the distractions, and I must be ADD because I can't focus or I am easily distracted on my own spirituality, and how I can remember every day to take time and with the family and work. That's what I'm
just thinking. This really helps me to hear. Let me just start a little bit with some response and then go to sort of my hopes and aims and then talk about sanctifying the ordinary. And my hope is that I'll bring some things to you, ideas and practices and thoughts and struggles, and that there'll be plenty of space in our time to hear you talk back, to talk with each other, to you know, stop me when I said something that you want to hear more or come back to. But when I hear all of you introduce yourselves, I really hear 2 really basic needs. I hear some of you just in the midst of it, and this perception that we have about spirituality that has always sanctified not the ordinary, but stepping out of it, quiet time, mountaintop experiences, formal worship. And so those of us who are deeply immersed in the care of children or in relational spouse and partnership tend to think that that's time off from real practice of faith, and the tradition has tended to convey that message. So I hear, and that does get to one of my, probably one of the deepest aims I have, is to help us reconceive spirituality, not to neglect or to deny the importance of solitude, silence, fleeing to the desert or the mountain, but to widen the circle of faith to be more inclusive of those who are deeply involved and literally cannot remove themselves from the demands of the daily and have to think of spirituality in fresh and new ways that are more inclusive. The second thing that I really hear, and it may be something that if we can't get to in the conversations that we have in the sessions, that can overflow to conversations beyond, which is, then how should the church ministry respond? Because several of you are in pastorates and struggling to change or think more creatively, and I have lots of ideas about that, because it's not adding another ministry, but you know, another youth service or another program for children that needs to occur. It's some deeper integrative working across the generations and rethinking how we do formation and education. So I hope we get to that too. That feels sometimes to me slightly further implications of what we're going to talk about in terms of practicing faith within families. I was really struck by your comment about parenting and a spouse relationship being maybe the most deeply formative spiritual experiences that you've had. And I think in some ways, that's the conviction that is partly, not the only one, but a really powerful conviction that has driven my work. That we are not just, for those of you who are looking towards parenting children, that we're not just forming our children, they are forming us powerfully. And then in some ways, over against the tradition of education, that of in the Christian tradition, that really children form us, just the very experience of birthing, raising, and weathering some of the demands and trials of parenting. I really want to give back some of what I've been struggling with and learning, both personally and in my own professional life. I have three children. They are now 18, 20, and 23. I've been thinking about these issues since I began teaching when my only and oldest was 9 months. And so I've been really, these have been really for the question of how to rethink families and spirituality has really been something that I've been thinking a lot about. Holden Village actually has already had an impact on me. 4 years ago I was here and was thinking towards doing a book and did sessions on family and spiritual practice. And the book that evolved is In the Midst of Chaos, Care of Children as Spiritual Practice. And Holden, in some ways, part of my aim to doing this again is to give back again some of the things that worked their way into the book just by being here at Holden. I think in just one example, Holden really models an inclusivity of generations that the church itself can model, but is very rare in most places in contemporary society. And so the presence and inclusive nature of this community. But there are other stories I tell that come really from that week of being here that communicated things to me. So in the last session this week, I'll be talking about the practice of blessing and letting go. And the Holden prayer that has blessed many people on their departure is an example of the power of blessing and letting go. For today, I want to talk about sanctifying the ordinary. And one of the stories from Holden that I was really struck by is in the history of this community. You had a powerful figure who was here and who during worship would pass the peace by saying, "May the peace of Christ disturb you." And so as we think about, I'll come back to that story, as we think about sanctifying the ordinary, one of the things you'll hear me doing is disturbing our stereotypes of what Christian peace is. Because when she said, "May the peace of Christ disturb you," she was challenging the hope that we have that peace is something of calm, quiescent, passive, centered restfulness. That in fact, sometimes peace of Christ pushes us to new challenges, makes us go places we wouldn't want to go, and that maybe the peace of Christ is not just being relaxed and untroubled. That peace actually might be, Christ's peace might be much more complicated than that. So Holden's stories that have made this place did work their way into this book. Its really center question is, how do we sustain faith in the midst of it all? That's the question that drove the book. And maybe it grew out of my own struggles. I want to tell a couple stories that I think will speak to some of you who introduced yourselves. My own story, just a snippet, a paradigmatic or sort of revelatory moment for me, occurred when I was trying to bathe two or three of my small children, who at that point were 2, 4, and 7. We tried to get two or three of them in the tub at once. And I was teaching pastoral care to ministers, future ministry students, and I wanted to include in that course something on spirituality, and I had assigned Henry Nouwen's book on the Desert Fathers. And as some of us parents do, I was sort of multitasking, and they were in the tub, and I'm kind of looking at this book for the day tomorrow, and kind of, and the message of the book was that the three essential pieces of genuine Christian spirituality were flee to the desert, be silent, and prayer. And it really struck me how ill-fitting those three were for my life. And that they were almost foreign, that I couldn't flee the immediate responsibilities of fear. And then, in fact, be silent was the antithesis, the opposite of what I was watching my child in the tub play with language, that words were empowering for the child, and that silence was not where the richness of the relationship was, but it was in conversation. And that prayer had to be a different, very different sort of prayer than the prayer that might evolve out of fleeing and being silent. That it had to be a prayer in the midst of all of this, sometimes provoked by what was being said to me, by what my children were doing. And so I really began to think about the traditions that we've inherited, the received tradition that has conveyed messages about spirituality that really were ill-fitting for most of us, and often even for a minister's life. This is replicated, I think, where ministry is quite a bit like family life in terms of its interruptions being pervasively part of the practices of ministry and caregiving and family. A second story that I came across, I think what helped me is I came across other people. I found I wasn't alone, that there were many other people that had thought about this. I came across the story of an Anglican theologian who had heard the story of a woman who had spoken to three different Anglican priests about her distress, young, exhausted mother trying, had found her emotional, and spiritual life, her devotional life in disarray after the birth of her child. And the theologian Janet Soskis writes this: the mother received this advice from three priests. The first told her that if her baby woke at 6, she should rise at 5 for a quiet hour of prayer. The second asked her if her husband could not arrange to come home early from work 3 days a week so she could get to Mass. This advice proved threatening to life and marriage. And for those of you who are, for those of you who are sharing the labor, it's a lot to ask for more time. And the third told her, relax, just look after your baby. The rest of the church is praying for you. Mixed reactions. Of the three pieces, this may be the most deeply sanctioned by the Christian tradition, that when we can't pray, the full community can pray for us, that we can be supported and be supported by the rest of the community. But I think the gaps, I'd love to hear what you're thinking, partly come from a sense of, does this also convey that you're basically, as Janet Soskis say, Christians on idle for the 20 years that you're parenting? The remark, I think, implies that the faith life I write of a busy parent must simply be put on hold. And that there are Christians on idle, taking some years off from their faith while others seek God on their behalf. So this is the received tradition really gives us these mixed messages. So how then do we redeem this practice of sanctifying the ordinary? What I discovered is that in some ways there are pockets in the longer Christian tradition, certainly in the Roman Catholic tradition, of practicing the faith in the midst of the ordinary. The Benedictines have a rule of order that orders life around work, prayer, and reading. So work is very integrated with prayer. It's not set aside. So there are pockets in the tradition of trying to integrate faith in the midst of life. But in the Catholic tradition, much of this was still within religious life, separated out from family life, and fewer people have really thought about it in the midst of parenting. But what I found, and there's a section in the early chapters on sanctifying the ordinary that I entitled, What a Friend I Have in Luther. And I'm not Lutheran. I'm disciples, Christian Church disciples of Christ. But Luther, in some ways, revolutionized the idea of where religion and where religious life is most found. He challenged the idea that you have to go off and join a separate community. And he actually blessed the vocations of everyone in all walks of life. But I think more powerfully than his questioning religious orders as and blessing family life as a place where faith could be found was his own words of his own parenting. He wrote words, as he always, in many ways, was very provocative writer. And when I stumbled across his words that he wrote out of his own life, I realized we tend to forget what a friend we have in Luther. And just listen to his words. He basically, as you all probably know better than I, wed Catherine Van Bora, a strong person herself. They had six of their own children and four others they took in, 10 children. And here's what he wrote, a male theologian who, when I stumbled across his words, I learned to suspect as a woman in theology and, you know, thinking, what do these patriarchal of men of the tradition know? Here are his words. He declares domestic work holy, godly, precious. When our natural reason, he's talking to those that upheld sort of the Greek ideal of reason, takes a look at married life, she turns up her nose and says, alas, must I rock the baby, wash its diapers, make its bed, smell its stench, stay up nights with it, take care of it when it cries, heal its rashes and sores, and on top of that, take care of my wife, provide for her. Isn't he amazing? This is all one sentence, so I take a breath. Provide for her, labor at my trade, take care of this, take care of that, do that, endure this, endure that, and whatever else of bitterness and drudgery married life involves. What shall I make? What should I make such a prisoner of myself? One hears echoes here, this is my sort of side comment, of the Greek view of the body as a prison of the rational mind and soul. The Christian tradition challenged that and said the body is not a prison of the soul. The body is good, created good. And Luther was deeply convicted about that. What then does Christian faith say to this, back to Luther's word? It opens its eyes. looks upon all these insignificant, distasteful, despised duties in the spirit, and is aware that they are all adorned with divine approval, as with the costliest gold and jewels. I confess to thee that I am not worthy to rock the little babe or wash its diapers or to be entrusted with the care of the child and its mother. Oh, how gladly will I do so, though the duties should be even more insignificant and despised. Neither frost nor heat nor drudgery nor labor will distress or dissuade me, for I am certain that it is thus pleasing in God's sight. This sort of gets us ahead to tomorrow, where I'm going to talk about paying attention. Because what I find when I read this, what I just found reading this passage out loud, is it's a drastic change of perspective. He sees something different in the daily that he hadn't seen before, of divine sanction and blessing. His words helped me, as well as did another woman who is a Roman Catholic medievalist scholar, but who wrote on the spiritual life. She herself wrote out of a life that didn't include biological parenting, but she seemed to know something significant about the what she described aesthetic opportunity par excellence. What does she mean by that? Parenting, she says, is the aesthetic opportunity par excellence. Traditionally, we think of asceticism as, again, a practice of the desert fathers, where we use disciplines of self-denial and world renunciation, fasting, celibacy, to draw closer to God. Dreyer took this image and she turns it upside down. And she argues that if you regard parenting from the right angle, our daily life with its drudgery that Luther describes has an oddly haunting resemblance to this life of self-denial or renunciation. It ought to be appreciated for what it does. And these are her words, and my words first. Unbidden and unexpected opportunities arise for this similar kind of sort of disciplined faith practice in the midst of caring. Her words, a full night's sleep, time to oneself, the freedom to come and go as one pleases. All this must be given up. Huge chunks of life are laid down at the behest of infants. And then later, parents must let go. I feel like in that sentence, she has the bookends of this book. Because the last day, I'm going to talk about another practice, which is blessing and letting go, which is a constant piece of daily, mundane parental practice. And she says it right here. You lay down your life, really, in many ways, and then you must let go. What a huge, again, aesthetic opportunity par excellence. I cannot tell you how relieved I felt when I first stumbled across these words.
What is her name?
Her name, this is Elizabeth Dreyer. Dreyer. And this is an article that she wrote. And I'm happy to give you the full citation of where I found this. But these words really allowed me to see what I was doing and connect what I was doing in the midst of my daily practices of life with my faith. Instead of saying to myself, I can't get to a silent minute of prayer, I could see what I was doing as its own formative value and importance. So when I, this changed even my, now when I, the first question you commonly hear asked a parent with a small child is, how many hours does she sleep? Or is she sleeping through the night? And I realized that on one level this is a deeply spiritual question about faith, if you hear it in the right way. About the care and practice of love, we don't think of it this way. My third son didn't sleep much. He'd been my first, he would have been my last. And I, of course, I thought with my first son, I'm really good at this.
Yes.
I don't know what your problem is. But if you just put them down the right way and leave them, if they cry a little for a couple minutes, you know, they'll go, well, no, this one didn't stop crying. So it was a good lesson in my own limits. And we spent days really delirious, teetering on the edges of sleeplessness and exhaustion and poor judgment, gaining empathy for parents that turn to abuse, that you can hardly sustain your self-sanity. And so to see this daily regimen of care, restraint, self-extension, and craziness as part of a larger practice of faith was revolutionary for me, sanctifying the ordinary in fresh ways. So that's some of what I want to put on the table. What do I mean by finding everyday practices that form our faith? When we talk about faith practices, if I just ask you, what faith practice comes to mind? What's a faith practice?
Sharing family meals.
Sharing family meals. So you've already made the transition. Because that, when you say that, I think we tend to, sometimes think reading scripture, praying,
meditation,
going to church. But we forget that sharing a family meal, that food, and the common take for taking of it. That's actually, when I had to think, what practices do I want to include in this book? That was one I didn't do. It could be a whole chapter.
And yet it's a practice that in so many families is missing, either because of work schedules, or we're finding with sports and marching band schedules. We still do pretty well, but and I think we do better than a lot of the families in the churches that we serve.
Well, there are meals where the television is the central part of the meal, families I know.
Yeah.
And it's, I haven't heard they call that sharing a meal together.
I call it out because it takes intention for us to make that a priority. And I think that in some ways that embodies a faith walk, and that it's very easy to let go of that or to lose sight of that intention. And yet at the same time, it's a great place to start because it can take great effort, but it doesn't involve getting in a car and going to a church or figuring out when the service starts. You have a lot of control over how that plays out, and it can play out differently, but it does take intention for so many of us.
And the word intention is really a helpful one. Let me tell you the faith practices that I ended up writing about, and then how I was thinking about how I want people to think about their own, when you think about your own life, what chapter would you write? What chapter would you write if you had to write one at your own place? And the sanctifying the ordinary was the chapter. Paying attention, I talked about as a practice. Reading as a spiritual practice. Doing justice. Playing, and we talked about all the sports and different playing activities our kids do, was another chapter. Blessing and letting go. Giving unto others, but what about myself, is another chapter. When I, in some ways, try to decide what chapters I would write out of my own life wasn't an easy task. And one of my good friends said to me, your family, you read a lot. Even your kids read a lot. We're just readers. Think about a chapter on real. And I really didn't see it. It almost took someone else from outside to say, this is something that you seem to practice. One of my good friends who has two kids close to the same ages as my own, knew I was doing a chapter on reading and instantly said, oh, we don't really read, and you know, that's not my thing. And I was so struck when she said that, because she practices the practice of hospitality. And I wanted to say, you don't have to pick up the practice of reading. You already have a practice you cultivate. That you, she didn't really realize. She, a Jewish friend, she invited us over for the Shabbat when I could hardly cook, dress, and get my kids together. So she made space in her life. That was what she was good at. And she was conveying, I think, this practice to her own children. So everyone has different practices that they are more prone to or more like, that come out of already out of their own lives. And it struck me that lots of spiritual books on faith and on the self-help shelf at the bookstore just add, you read them and you have one more thing to do.
Was her name Martha?
Yeah. No, we'll come back.
Just trying to connect.
We'll come back to Martha. Yeah, one more thing to do. But that was really the opposite of what I hoped. I think this book is a book of grace, to find what you're already doing. And to say, I don't have to add one more thing. I don't have to add one more thing. I have to find what I'm already doing and find ways in which it can be more fully embodying the presence of God in my, and practicing the honing and shaping of my faith. I stumbled across a book that Kathleen Norris did on doing, I don't think this is the title, but on doing laundry. And she wrote a small article that she got more responses to on how she had found God in the midst of the routine of doing laundry. And when I talk about this in the book, I'm not saying that that's going to be true for everyone. And there are days, I actually really, I love doing laundry. I think I'm not so keen on it. But there are days when even laundry is overwhelming and not a favorite practice. But to be able to take something mundane and to say there are ways in which it can quickly open itself to God's presence. Yeah.
I've had that experience with laundry, partly because at this time last year I was in treatment for breast cancer. It was very long and hard, 8.5 months. And I couldn't do it because I was too wiped out from 5.5 months of chemotherapy. So I had to have friends come in and do our laundry. And I remember sitting at the laundromat with a friend of mine, and she had like 20 washing machines going at once to get all the week's worth of laundry or whatever into these, you know, smaller machines, because the triple loaders were taken. And so when I was able to do the laundry again, I thought it is such a blessing to do the normal things. So I really found sacredness in the normal. And I find, since my treatment, I don't begrudge doing the laundry, because I remind myself what a gift it is to be able to do the normal things. So even if it's washing dishes or doing the laundry, that there's a sacredness to normalcy, which, you know, I really missed when I couldn't be normal. I couldn't function normally. So then the laundry kind of became more of a sacred task because I was able to do it.
Yeah, like grandma-like figure in our life who, when she folded the laundry, she would pray for the person whose clothes she was folding. And that's always kind of stuck with me. I think that's interesting.
I know someone who does have a desk. Only keeps things in his house that have stories attached to them. When he lifts up the bell or the saucer or the vase, reminds himself of who that connects him to.
Yeah.
I think it'd be fruitful to hear you just think of what this has provoked for you. What practices or does it allow you to see things differently? And while you're thinking about that, I'd like you to talk with each other and ask to me about it. But I don't want to leave this Martha. I read the scripture from Luke. I want to come back to it before hearing more from you, just to say, through the first and second chapter of this book, I found myself really wanting to challenge the truncated way we've seen things, and Martha was one. We really are unfair to her, and the Christian tradition overall has really interpreted her as the, she's sort of the foil. She's the negative, the black sheep. She's, and what's interesting is when I've talked with groups before, and particularly women, lots of women identify with her. They don't really identify with Mary. So what is that history of interpretation doing to women? I think it's pretty damaging. And what was really nice is a good friend of mine, Stephanie Paulsell, who teaches also and has thought lots about spirituality and actually looked at spirituality and reading some, pointed me towards Meister Eckhart. And I'm not an historian, but he is a medievalist. I hope I'm getting this correct, even the dates, I'm not sure. But he is one sole figure. If I can find his words, where I quoted him here, who actually redeemed Martha. And let me see if I can just find some of his words that I quote. I'm having trouble finding this page, but this is not like the page number. Here are his words. These are my words, taking some of his words. Let me just read. Martha is not the epitome of unfaithfulness. In her concern about work, she solicits and prepares for God's grace. In fact, it is not self-evident that Jesus rebukes her. But honestly, when I read this out loud, it's hard not to hear. I've heard that so much as a rebuke, but Eckhart says no. He was a 13th century, I have it in my book, Dominican theologian and mystic. And those who want to redeem Martha have an ally in his work. In his sermon on this passage, he praises her. She is worried about Mary, he says, because Martha has, quote, in his words, lived long and well. And living gives the most valuable kind of knowledge about God. Those are his words. Mary, she fears, has mistaken enjoyment for genuine faith. And one could imagine another scene that we're not told, where Jesus has much to say to Mary. Our scriptures seem to be finite, but the Jewish tradition creates a wonderful practice of midrash and tells the stories that aren't told. And plays with the text and what might be the further reading. And I can imagine a time when Jesus might have spoken with Mary. So Jesus is not chastising Martha at all, according to Eckhart. Then he calls her name twice, Martha, Martha. He says, you are worried and distracted by many things. When he calls her name twice, he says, it's an indication of his blessing and of her completeness, that our work in time, just as Martha's activity and service, can indeed bring us closer to God. And these are, again, his words, as the most sublime thing that can happen to us, except for seeing God, unquote, in God's pure nature. So when Jesus says Martha has many cares, he means that she is, again, in his words, so grounded in being that her activity did not hinder her. Work and activity led her to eternal happiness. She only wants the same for Mary. This isn't to honor the drudgery and the routine and getting so caught up that you don't see Jesus in the room. But it is to say that maybe Martha isn't always all wrong. that there's something to sanctify the ordinary work of our lives. I'd love to hear some of your thoughts.
Would probably say that, agree that Martha had the gift of hospitality, most likely?
Yes, that's exactly. It's a wonderful way. Had not thought about that, but she knows how to make a space for Jesus, to feed him.
And
what it takes to feed people.
that was that was one of her gifts from God. And yeah. So she was fulfilling
it.
Serving in that way, you probably didn't understand why Mary shouldn't have the same gift or have the same, serve in the same way. But Mary was a different person.
Right.
And so I see Jesus as pointing out that telling Martha that, well, not everybody's like you, and Mary needs this right now. That's what you are doing.
And some of it is about balance. I think sometimes I write this and I know for myself I need immense amounts of time in silence and quiet. So I do think determining what Mary needs, what Martha needs, and ways in which we practice our faith very differently is a really key part of this. In some ways, I think my vocation of teaching is predicated on many hours by myself, but that is partly how I've been managed in the midst of chaos. So I think that it isn't just about balance. It really is about honoring the chaos and honoring Martha. But there is a piece of finding our place in the spectrum of faith practices.
Yeah. When you, I realized when we were talking about family meals together, I moved to sort of the judgmental. Some families don't think this is important enough, and I really appreciate your corrective of that families, like churches, like the religious orders, have charisms, have gifts. And perhaps one of our, now sort of put it on my clergy head, is to help families rather than to say, here's, you know, one more damn thing you have to do to be faithful. Is to help them identify what their charisms are that they're already living out,
yes.
to sacramentalize their lives by doing nothing more than saying, this is God's work you're doing. And so for your family, the sacrament of reading, now not everyone in your family may be the same kind of reader, but that's a place that your family finds nurture and growth and formation. For others, you mentioned moment hospitality. It could be eating together. I realize our family spends inordinate amounts of time talking about the news. Our children are very well versed on, you know, what country's been invaded, and not all families do that, and nor should they. It's just where kind of our interests are. So a world awareness is I never thought of it as a charism, just sort of as an oddity or a quirk.
I like the use of that word, that identifying the charisms of a family, what's already a ritually practiced, and then being more intentional about it. So I think that really is key. And I think you could pair that with helping families or helping yourselves do particular practices better.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be great value in talking about how we could eat together better. That the Christian tradition has some things to say about what it means to commune. That we know what communion means, you know, so we could talk more about perfecting practices in general. So there is a way in which when I do the session on reading, I do hope I spark interest for people who might not think of it as a charism to deepen it. Because honestly, till I started thinking about it, just like you did with the news, I did not realize how much we had used books, not scripture. I mean, we were reading about, we had Tommy DePaulo's, you know, Parables of Jesus. We did read that out loud. But it was other books that we read that were, I didn't know that I was using to think through life's deep existential, moral, and spiritual questions. And I was, they were ways that I let, they allowed my children to grapple with difficult questions. One of the books I'll talk about, just as an example, that really is one of the favorites and a favorite author, this is children sort of 6 to 12 maybe, is Patricia Polacco. Has anybody stumbled across her writing? Oh, she has a book, and we moved to the Mid-South from the Midwest when my kids were 4, 6, and 9. And she has a book about a story out of the Civil War that is a partially true, actually the true story that she is telling out of her family tradition called Pink and Sag. And it is about the strife, conflict of war.
And
Pink and Say. Pink, those, they're two boys' names, P-I-N-K and Say, S-A-Y. And it is one of those books, stories that when I read, I couldn't get through it without crying. My kids started teasing me about it. But it was, it's just a powerful story about conflict and reconciliation across race and more, I think. But
how do you spell her name?
Polacco. You know, I'm not...
P-O-L-A-C-C-O.
But there's, the authors like that are abound. You know, Tommy DePaulo is probably a more clear, recognizable crossover author who does biblical stories as well as non-folklore from Scotland. That kind of thing. But to recognize reading and perfect it, or perfect it's not the right word. I'd be a Methodist word. I teach at Vanderbilt, I'm around a lot of Methodists. But I think to hone practice and help families hone practices is maybe part of what I'm hoping. I think the bell is rung and lunch has come. I feel like, is there any last people wanting to say something that was on?
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
How old are your kids?
14, 12, and 10.
Okay. I'm just curious because it's interesting you said the thing about the news and watching the news together. In fact, that's a part of me that I always did, and I've given up since I had children because I'm so protective of them. I don't want them to watch the news. I don't want them to know about all the evil in the world. And I wonder when it's an appropriate age to reintegrate that and introduce him to that. Because up to now, he knows nothing about evil.
Are they watching the news or reading the news?
No, we don't have TV.
There's a difference too between
watch the news.
We listen to it on the radio and internet. But like when we used to commute to school, and it was right when the sexual abuse scandal of the priests came out. You know, you just have the news on, sure, but I'm listening to it, and they're, and Daddy, what's sexual abuse? All right, so we're going to talk, yeah, you can't bitch it at that point. It's,
right.
And, but sort of find the level at which they can understand it and not sort of take in what they can and not what they can't.
I shouldn't say anything, goes to public schools. but it's interesting because I've always been interested in politics and current events and stuff and having conversation with grown-ups about that. And it's just a part of my life I've absolutely had to give up since I've had children.
I would invite you, and it's almost like the sentence, I almost had to give up prayer. I would invite you not to give up what are your loves and to share that love with your kids. And because I really was glad you qualified that he knows nothing about evil. Because one of the chapters in the book is taking children seriously. And what's so interesting about the research and my own reflection on children is children know so much more than we realize. And I think you're right. And in fact, some people back to reading have praised Marie Sendak's work because he puts so powerfully in his books evil, and partly because he's convinced that children do know. And not only do they know, but they are hungry to talk about this. And so I don't know how many people came this morning. Maybe she didn't tell this story this morning, but the person, Diane, who's doing the Bible study, had last week, the Bible study was on Job, and she was profoundly moved by a 10-year-old who came. And that 10-year-old was hungry and dissatisfied with our churches. because she wasn't getting conversation about things like Job in her Sunday school. And we underestimate, I underestimated as a parent, the wisdom, not to be romanticizing or idealizing the children. I think that's a really fine balance. Oh, children are so cute, aren't they so wise? I don't want to go there, but to say that children know more than we often grasp and maybe more eager. And that you, it seems to me, you have a charism of using this as a way of forming faith. And I think that dealing with media is another place we practice faith. You know, I did that a lot. Did you see that commercial? What's that commercial about? That was, TV watching was really a faith, well, forming time, not to let those times escape. But you all need to escape. Thanks for coming.